Hey, how's it going? Before we begin, I want to take a minute to thank everyone who's supported the Discovering Bitcoin podcast by sending, streaming, and boosting precious Satoshis via value for value apps like Fountain and Breeze, or Zaps via Nosta. Hearing tales of discovery and recording episodes of this podcast keeps me sane, and your support motivates me to keep going more than you will ever know. Thank you. Are you new to discovering Bitcoin, the network, the asset, the money? Do you want to get up to speed on self-custody, join the evolution, and know how to hodl your Bitcoin safely, securely, and simply? Discover the Bitcoin Advisor, a dedicated team of proper Bitcoiners, hardcore, ardent maximalists, whose sole purpose is to help you to discover Bitcoin, steer well clear of shitcoins, take self-custody, become sovereign, and ensure that you feel confident every step of the way. Click through to the BitcoinAdvisor.com link located in the show notes and tell them DJ from Discovering Bitcoin sent you. Your first month's free when you do.
Can you explain why Bitcoin is such an attractive financial tool?
Because it is somewhat anonymous, not fully, and because you can move money instantaneously.
So the one thing we can count on is
discovery.
Bitcoin goes forward in the year 2024.
In the little words of the Doors,
12, 11, 10,
the time to hesitate
9,
is through.
Ignition sequence start.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
All engine running.
Daniel, how you going, man?
Hey, glad to be here.
How did you discover Bitcoin?
So I have to go back a while, and it's based on the phrase that I like to say, which is, you know, it's not about how many years you've been in Bitcoin; it's how many years were you thinking about Bitcoin, waiting for Bitcoin to exist before you found out about it. So for me, that was quite some time. And I remember a long time ago, I was talking with my grandmother, and she was saying that, you know, we need to, reach out to this cousin and, you know, give her updates on something. And I said, well, we can just send an email. And she said, no, she's out of town, you know, so she won't get it till, you know, she won't get it till she gets home. And I said, no, she'll get the email immediately. And my grandmother said, well, how does the email know where she is? Right. And it just got me thinking about how, you know, technology gets better, right? The old phone system where you're calling somebody's home. And then if you're calling a further distance, it costs more money. And maybe some countries, you know, it's very difficult or impossible to call. And you need to know where somebody is. And then all that just kind of went away. And then you have things like email and voice over IP. And then you're just simply, you have access to the internet. They have access to the internet. And it doesn't matter where you are. You could be driving down the highway in Australia. And the other person could be, you know, climbing a mountain in Argentina. And they can still talk to each other. Right. And that that all abstracted away. And in fact, you know, the cost is much better. Right. And they're isn't this whole archaic infrastructure of lots of companies that do things in an old, difficult way to deal with. And it's beautiful, right? So certainly that was missing for the internet for a long time, right? And there were all these little pieces in there, like the payment code for the HTTP, you know, payment missing code 402, right? That you needed. You know, people were waiting for something like that, some kind of digital cash. And I certainly was too, because there's all this friction of paying somebody, right? If you go up to a vending machine, you know, you can put in, a bill or a coin and there you go, right? Or back in the old days, a payphone. And then when you have the internet, there just simply wasn't a way to do that. You can't just put a coin or a bill into the tray on your tower desktop computer. It would have been nice, right? But, that was still this unsolved problem, and kind of waiting for the legacy institutions that are still running mainframes with COBOL and then there's just one guy that they're hoping never retires who knows how it all works. They're not going to do that for a lot of reasons, right? They're not going to be on the cutting edge of innovation, but also it just seems like it's an unsolvable problem. And, you know, while I was waiting for that and hoping someone would build it, it also was kind of that something that I wasn't sure was possible, right? Can you actually have a money system that's nobody's in charge of, that's digital, but can't be replicated, where people actually agree on what it is and where it is and who has that much? Because it's all about the incentives, right? People have a very strong incentive to try to give themselves more money, to try to counterfeit more money for themselves, because the gain is concentrated and the pain is diluted. It's spread out. If somebody, you know, has a little magic box and they hit the button and, you know, some currency comes out of nowhere from it, then it seems like nobody's being hurt by that. They think, wow, I just went to the restaurant and I tipped the server very generously and everybody seems happy. Who's unhappy? And who's unhappy is that every time a new $100 bill comes out of this machine, every single other dollar in existence loses a tiny bit of value. Just like the, you know, when people were transacting with gold coins and then they would, you know, make a standardized one stamped with the image of the king on it, people started shaving off the edges just a tiny bit each time they received a coin and before they spent it. Mm-hmm. And then eventually those shavings added up, right? Nobody noticed it. And then they started putting little ridges on the edges of the coins to prevent people from shaving off those bits. So I was waiting for, you know, something like Bitcoin to be invented for a while, but there's multiple paths that would have led me there, because I've met other people that got into Bitcoin one way or another. And for some people, they were pulled in by like libertarian politics. For some people, it's just a passion about like technology or coding. For other people, they were in like commodities trading or finance. And for some people, they were just, you know, people were looking for a way to try to, you know, make some money, right? To get off the hamster wheel of just working and earning just enough to pay the rent. And then there were people who were interested in saying, what can I do with my CPU power? What can I do with this computer I have sitting there, right? And that turned out to be the one for me, even though all the other ones would have caught up with me eventually. I don't know. Have you seen the Bond movie GoldenEye from the 90s?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Play the video game.
Right. So so the bad guy's lair, spoiler alert, is this giant satellite dish in the jungle, right? Maybe, you know, over 300 meters across. And it's shocking because it's actually a real place, right? This is the Arecibo satellite dish in Puerto Rico, and it's able to, you know, send and receive messages, or at least it was till it was tragically destroyed a few years ago, send and receive messages into outer space, right, to communicate with other galaxies potentially. The only problem is that even though it's been around for decades, nobody was actually talking back, right? So they were sending messages out there and they were listening and hoping that there would be something there. So they started collecting all this data, but they just didn't have the computing power to actually analyze all of it for repeating signals to suggest that it could be some kind of communication from an extraterrestrial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So in the 90s, what happened was all of a sudden, regular people are buying powerful computers at home, and then they have internet access, and those computers are sitting idle most of the time. So, you know, you have this powerful computer, and maybe you use some of its power a little bit, right? But 95% of the time, 90%+ of the time, it's idle, or it's not being used to its full amount. So they realized, like, okay, there's all these computers out there that are idle, and we don't have the budget for a supercomputer ourselves, but maybe people would want to contribute it, because this problem is what they call in computer science embarrassingly parallelizable, hard to say, where it's just so trivial to break it into separate pieces, because, you know, you have this chunk of time and I have that chunk of time and we don't need to talk to each other. The only thing you want to hear from me is, did I find an alien signal or not, right? And that's the only thing I want to hear from you. And other than that, we don't need to collaborate in any way. Mm-hmm. So they created this program called SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, where they were breaking up their raw data into blocks, and you could go download a block, and then your computer would just sit away churning at it for 10 hours, you know, and all the time if you wanted. And then it would, you know, you would have an interesting screensaver showing you some of the calculations it was doing. But ultimately, you know, that's it. You now are using your CPU at 100%, and the only reward is maybe you'll find an alien. And I didn't find any aliens, right? Wow. And that was disappointing. It would have been exciting to be like, hey, you know, I got that message from, from Alpha Centauri, and they're only, you know, four sunlight years away. We can make it there. We can make it, right? anyway, so that was that kind of thing where I just think, you know, hey, I have these computing resources. I want to use them, and what's something that they could be used for? So I happen, I am the kind of person that, you know, will spend a few hours a day just reading about new technology or interesting things in general. And it's kind of crazy, you know, how much you can come across in that way, right? Whether it's Wikipedia or tech blogs or other things like that. And I came across on a tech blog, they said, hey, you know, some Japanese guy has made up some new, you know, internet currency or something. So, you know, you basically can try to make some using your own computing power. So, you know, check it out. And they always had a notoriously negative slant, right? Despite being early to things, because the same tech blog, you know, when the original iPod came out, they're like, oh, this is expensive and stupid, you know, it'll probably fail like everything else Apple does, right? that iPod ended up becoming the iPhone and ended up becoming smartphones and, you know, changing the world and making Apple the most valuable company in the world from, you know, the edge of bankruptcy.
It's so crazy. A lot of people actually forget that, huh? Like that the iPhone and smartphones in general evolved out of the iPod.
Right. The original one was FireWire only, a port nobody had. It was $400, which was a lot of money in 2001, at least in the US. It was probably more elsewhere in the world. And it only held 5 gigabytes, and it was big and heavy and didn't have a touchscreen, and it was black and white and, you know, pretty limited in what it can do. But still, that was just the first iteration of it. Right. So I'm like, OK, well, let me see if I can, you know, use my computing power and see if I can find some Bitcoins. And, you know, I didn't really think about it, you know, too much after that, because I wasn't part of any community. I wasn't getting any updates about that or whatever. But I was, you know, cautiously optimistic, right? And I've met plenty of people that they say like, oh, when they first heard about Bitcoin, their first thought was absolutely no way, you know, and then they had another touch point, and then they came around to it. And in fact, there's a prominent person in the Bitcoin space. I'm not sure if I should say their name, but, you know, they said they first heard about Bitcoin in 2011 and, you know, dismissed it, heard about it again. And, you know,
Adam Back did that, right?
2013 ignored it. Then 2017, like, okay, finally.
Came around. Well, I mean, Adam Back is on the record saying that, you know, he dismissed Bitcoin out of hand. And it took him until 2013 or something to sort of pick it apart.
Yeah, which is pretty late when you've actually emailed Satoshi yourself.
Yeah, and you're on the
2013 is relatively early, but when you're on the Cypherpunk's mailing list and the cryptography,
and you cited in the white paper,
you should notice a little bit sooner than that.
Yeah, but you know, that just goes to show we're all fallible, right?
Absolutely. So that's very understandable, because that's sort of the way the whole thing comes across initially, right? And there were certain different other things, obviously not Bitcoin, where someone's like, oh, this is, you know, some interesting, exciting opportunity. And I think, okay, cool. And then I look into it and I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess that doesn't work. That's not going anywhere. And there were attempts to try to make internet currencies like Flues, for example. There was a company called Flues.com. during the dot-com mania of the late 90s. And they said, okay, yeah, we're issuing our own, you know, currency. You know, you can put all your money into Flues bucks. And as you might imagine, it ended in tears, right? Because this is a central company and they can't just do this kind of thing without a lot of things going wrong from both the regulatory side and their internal management and so on. And then you get some article in 2000 or whatever, some person's like, I put my life savings into Flew's Bucks and now the company's gone. Like, yeah, yeah, that's all right. So anyway, I thought, okay, well, maybe the computer will be turning away. And this was, you know, super underpowered desktop or whatever. And I didn't think about it for a while until, you know, later then, you know, I heard something, you know, oh, hey, there's, you know, there's bubble in Bitcoin or whatever. And looking back, I'm like, gee, that's, you know, let's see if the, you know, was able to find anything, right? And it's like, hey, the computer actually did, you know, manage to come up with some Bitcoin, which is kind of incredible. And then I'm like, okay, I could, you know, what can I do with this, right? Well, you know, I could sell some of this Bitcoin and, you know, pay off some high interest credit card debt, which, you know, certainly seemed like a sensible thing to do at the time. Mm-hmm. But the irony being that that turned out to be actually a, you know, huge mistake, as the Bitcoin did easily outperform, you know, 20%+ per year after that point, right? And then I'm like, oh, I could also, you know, I can trade this on this exchange that, you know, is created called Mt. Gox. That's pretty neat. And I actually had a background in trading, right? I worked on an actual trading floor where, you know, like you may have seen on, you know, TV or whatever, where literally people are running around and screaming at each other and throwing bits of paper and, you know, holding up hand signals as they're buying and selling on behalf of themselves or on behalf of broker, you know, other people calling up on the phones and so on. Which was really a unique experience. And, you know, you learn a lot in a very visceral way. It's entirely different than sitting at a computer and seeing a bunch of screens and numbers and charts, which I also love to do. But that doesn't have the same feel of people actually crashing into you and feeling the energy of the crowd rise and fall and turn bullish or bearish. Yeah, wow. And that's sometimes one of the reasons that even people who are doing pure electronic trading, they like to have a squawk box or something, right? Or they like to have a troll box open where they can see the running commentary of other traders and get the feel of what's happening from there.
Isn't that interesting? I never knew that was a thing. I totally can understand the notion that when you're in a physical space with other people and there's an energy transfer between everybody, and if it's like in a sort of like a trading situation, a financial situation, that would feed into the frenzy and probably amplify it more. Whereas when you remove that and just have it on the screens, it's probably better from a more rational standpoint. Like you can make a clearer decision whether or not to make that particular trade. But then when you step it out all the way to just algos doing it, you know, in real time, that's, I guess, maybe, I don't know, it's not the Luddite in me, but like if those people that had those experiences in the 90s, they might, I don't know, like completely, it just results in a completely different outcome. I haven't really thought of that before, so I'm sort of stumbling over this thought.
And I like to, you know, I'll tell people, look, I'll share my trading knowledge. I'm happy to teach people, but most people should not be trading. Will lose money trading, right? Because they need to have some kind of edge, right? And that edge could be experience. The edge could be having more money. The edge could be having more insights or better tools or whatever else. But often people come to it and think, well, there's this free money, and but they have no edge at all. And they're just the sucker at the poker table, giving away money to everybody else over time. And maybe there's occasional wins that are memorable, but what matters is overall.
Yeah.
Right. So when on the actual trading floor, right, the edge was people actually physically being there because they have information before everybody else, you know, among other things, just the general sentiment in the room, the level of activity in the room. And what a lot of expert traders will tell you is that in order to be a good trader, you don't want to be emotionless. You don't want to be a robot, right? You can write a automated strategy and execute it. But if you're actually a human making decisions, emotions are actually valuable information, including your own. The issue with, you know, people who shouldn't be trading, right, the rookies or retail, as, you know, people might sometimes say, is that they're feeling the emotions and they're making the wrong decision, right? So when they're euphoric, they should be selling, not buying. And when they're nauseous and utterly terrified out of their mind, they should be buying, not selling. Right. And I've, you know, I noticed that myself, you know, if I catch myself, you know, Googling, you know, let me, you know, see some nice car or something, that's probably a local high. Right. And then if I'm thinking like, you know, do I really need two kidneys? You know, that might be a good time to buy, right? That might be a local low. You know, those kind of things where if you can still feel the emotions but step back from it and then have a dispassionate analysis of what you're feeling, then you can actually get some helpful information there, because we're certainly not at the point where the markets are totally efficient, right? Have you heard of the efficient market hypothesis?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so the idea, and there's different formulations of it, is that the markets are pricing in all the data that is actually publicly available. But sometimes that's not true, right? And especially when you have something that's fairly new. So when I worked on arbitrage strategies between different commodities markets, those were often minuscule amounts apart, right? They were very, very close. And, you know, the arbitrage bot really had to be executing things immediately to pick up these tiny discrepancies that would occasionally open up. And then I remember calling up some of the people that I worked with in commodities, and I said, hey, you know, Bitcoin's trading 20% higher on one exchange than another one. And it's been like that for a week. You know, I'm like, they remember, you know, you're trying to get arbitrage for like a, you know, 0.1% difference some of the time. You know, this is crazy. Like, this is, you know, what's the missing piece here, right? And the missing piece is that most people didn't even know that space existed, right? So when I later worked in a trading firm, right, they were doing what's called proprietary trading. So they were trading their own money. And we used to joke that this was the absolute dream job to have, right? Because you would come into the office and there are lots of screens, and, you know, you would make some manual trades or work on some trading bots, do some research and testing and so on. And we had phones, but the phones would never ring, right? Because literally nobody would ever call you for any reason, because there were no customers, there were no clients, there were no investors, there was no product.
Right.
You could just focus on the core business of making money. No external capital, no external anything of any kind other than your direct connection into the markets. And the office was literally, you know, had a line physically connected, right? So, this was in Chicago, actually, and we're trading those commodities markets. Hey, those, you know, exchange servers are actually quite close. So then, you know, people would joke around. They say, okay, well, all we need to do is just build some black box, you know, some magic black box, and we're going to just plug it into the wall and plug it into the exchange, and it's going to buy and sell, and it's just going to make money. You know, then we don't need to sit in an office, you know, in the cold Chicago winter. You know, it's going to make money on its own, and we can all just relax on some tropical island somewhere and enjoy the profits. I said, sure, we'll have this automated black box trading system, right? All we need to do is to raise money. We just need to, you know, test different strategies, get market data, you know, write the code, test the code, deploy it, you know, build in safety systems, you know, check for, you know, glitches and errors, you know, see if we need to basically scale it up, scale it down, modify it as the market changes, and then, you know, shut it off when necessary, right? But other than that, it's all automated. And one of the biggest pieces that you can automate, right, is something entirely new is created and it's not available on your existing exchanges yet, and there's a new way to trade that. And that kind of innovation is something that you know, it doesn't fit into the existing system. You really do need to think outside of the box, right? And I remember talking to somebody who was in the commodities markets, and I said, hey, you know, you should look into Bitcoin, you know, and he said, well, you know, what's the trading volume? And I'm like, well, it's pretty small right now. You would laugh, you know, but the point is, you know, you want to get a large piece of a small pie, right? Talked to someone else and they said, hey, Bitcoin. And they're like, what's the stock symbol? You know, they're all ready to punch it into their phone. I'm like, it doesn't have a stock symbol. By the point there is a stock symbol, the price will be higher. I said, the main thing that's keeping the price of Bitcoin low is that it's simply difficult to buy. Because when I first heard about Bitcoin, I was like, oh, where do I buy this? And I could not figure that out, right? That was just, you know, not possible. I mean, there probably was something, but it certainly wasn't anything, you know, convenient now, like an ETF or like Coinbase or, you know, Swan or River or something in that vein. Those were not a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And those, you know, that, and then you even see that with altcoins, where, you know, one of the biggest factors affecting altcoins price is it listed on an exchange with a lot of money sloshing around, right? How easy is it for people to buy it? And that's the driving factor there. So anyway, so I got to experience some of the pre-ASIC mining. And then, you know, then of course that becomes obsolete because the difficulty went up insanely fast back in the day. I mean, people think it's like, oh, it's up 100%, you know, recently now, whatever, in a year. That's nothing, right? It used to go up much, much, much faster. And so, you know, that was all obsolete. And I was like, man, you know, I want to be mining, you know, let me get an ASIC, right? So then I'm looking at ASICs, right? And then I see, okay, well, you can get it from Bitmain. And it's terrifying because their website looks like, you know, a relic from the 90s. And it's basically like, oh, hey, just send us your Bitcoin. And then, you know, in like a week, we're going to, you know, you'll get a box, you know, from us, you know, right from our factory in China.
We promise. Yeah.
And they plug it in to make money. And then, you know, it's obviously pretty scary because like, well, if I send them Bitcoin and they don't send me an ASIC miner, what am I going to do about it? Fly to China? Go bang on the factory doors and yell at them? Because email, that's what happened, you know, support to people. Yeah, the Mongok customer literally did that. It didn't help. All you did was waste money on an airline ticket. Aggravate yourself, you know? They should have been going to the onsen, at least enjoying their trip or something. Have some good sushi, but, you know? And, you know, again, so... Yeah, I got to experience, you know, Mt. Gox taking my money. But, you know, and obviously there were a lot of other dumb things I did. I made a presentation called Losing Bitcoin. And I started listing out the ways, you know, you can and have, you know, people can and have lost Bitcoin. I'm like, uh-oh, that's more than 200. That's not good. And when, you know, someone recently asked me, the person who doesn't care about Bitcoin at all, she's like, oh, the ETF just launched today. Should I buy some? And I'm like, well, it'd be better to buy physical Bitcoin as long as you're willing to take, you know, maybe a few hours to understand the proper way to do self-custody. And she's like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm like, yeah, then you should buy the ETF, right? If you're absolutely unwilling to just learn a few steps, then yeah, the ETF is outsourcing the custody. But I get it, because if you do it properly, it's fine. But if you don't do it properly, there's a lot of ways to screw that up. Especially earlier in Bitcoin's history, where we didn't have hardware wallets, we didn't have hierarchical deterministic backups, right? We didn't have the seed words.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, it was absurdly trivial for people to lose money. Basically, the early iterations of Bitcoin software, it was just creating a key for every address, and it would pre-generate 100 keys and 100 addresses. And then nobody was even backing up, right? But even if you did bother to back up those 100 keys, which was cumbersome and annoying to do so, then if you were actually using Bitcoin, eventually your balance would move off of those 100 keys and move on to new silently generated keys. And then if your computer crashed, guess what? Your backup only has the keys of addresses you used to have Bitcoin on, but no longer do. Mm-hmm. Not helpful. Mm-hmm. So you would basically have to keep constantly making a new backup all the time, which is just terrible, right? Mm-hmm. And also, right, the early iterations of Bitcoin, it was literally a program running on a Windows computer, which is particularly obscene. and, you know, the the key files were not even encrypted. So it's just writing the raw key data straight to a Windows computer. And, you know, I often wonder if somebody was firing up, one of those file sharing tools and just searching for wallet.dat back in those days. Right. That could have, because there are people who are, trying to download MP3 and then accidentally shared their whole hard drive. That's funny. One wonders. Yeah. And I mean, if somebody did that, I guess they're not sharing that story.
The way you explaining all of this, I mean, it requires such dedication, such intent, such will to be able to even pass all of that stuff, understand it, and that is one of the things where when people nowadays say, oh, well, I heard about it, a friend of mine said something, blah, blah, blah. Like, I can remember a friend that I used to work with mentioned it to me in, 2011. And at the time, I didn't really listen to much about what this person said. It was sort of like, oh, yeah, cool, sounds cool. Like, nerd. But if that had resonated with me, I was like, okay, cool, that sounds interesting. Let's go check it out. Me being the person that I am, I would have got to the next step and dismissed it then, sort of thing. Like, I'm just not that way inclined. And people beat themselves up. Oh, well, if, and I should have done that and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, do you know how much of a ball ache? I mean, you just described a giant ball ache of trying to retain any of these coins, whether or not you mine them on a computer back in the day or, traded them on Mt. Gox or whatever. Like, there's just an enormous minefield to wade through relative to now.
Absolutely. And, I created the Bitcoin OG text adventure game, just a silly little, text adventure game where you choose among the several possibilities for your next step, just to make fun of that, because, so many people said to me, like, oh, if I knew about, if I heard about Bitcoin in the early days, like, listen, plenty of people heard about Bitcoin in the early days. And, they're not sitting on a fortune of money. And that's exactly it. That, you could have lost the coins sitting on your own computer. You could have lost them depositing them into an exchange. You could have, traded them for barbecue coin, or a million other things that don't exist anymore. You could have, they could have appreciated 1,000x and you could have bought yourself a brand new, whatever, laptop or some other nice toy with that, maybe even printer. A car, and then realize, like, oh, 1,000x was just the appetizer. What about the next 1,000x, right?
Whoops. I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But then that's so abnormal, right? Because most things don't do that. There's, and then it left me, searching around, like, okay, what other things have actually increased, like, literally a 1,000,000,000%, right? From the first, mm-hmm. trade at a certain price. And it's a struggle, right? So there's the case of the graffiti artist, who did a mural for Facebook's like early office, basically. And they offered him, like, hey, do you want $60,000 or do you want the same amount in Facebook stock? And he's like, I'll take the stock. And that's worth, over $1 billion today.
Yeah.
Things like that. There's a limited number of those examples where something just becomes so absurdly valuable. Or if you think about, an acre of Manhattan real estate in the 1700s or something, what that was actually worth, and you just imagine, you get a time machine, you go back to an auction of an acre of Manhattan land in the 1700s and, you're outbidding everybody else, but not by too much, not to be suspicious, but you're outbidding everybody else for it. And they're like, you're crazy. Why are you paying, five times as much as, for this land? You'll never grow enough carrots on the land to justify that. And you say, no, don't worry. Like, this acre, I'm going to subdivide it into a couple pieces. And then on each of the pieces, I'm going to build a 100-story building. And each 100-story building is going to have 1,000, luxury units on it. And each one of those, I'm going to sell to some, rich guy in another country for $100 million.
And they just would have laughed you out of the field.
Yeah, and they'd be like, you're making zero sense right now. You're a crazy person. All right, whatever. We're happy to take your money. you know, good luck growing carrots.
Yeah.
Because that was farmland. It was farmland. That was swamp. That was, you know, it was nothing at all, right? And it wasn't. And then the value just starts creeping up, right? Because then those farms get replaced with townhouses that go replaced with low rises and so on, and then high rises. And you realize you can use each inch of that land can be utilized more and more and more than you even could possibly think by another whole order of magnitude. And it was just, you know, a bunch of people sitting under a tree in Manhattan that becomes an exchange, right? And, you know, a bunch of people meet there and they say, hey, well, I want to buy some of this and I want to sell some of that. And that turns into these proper exchanges. And that's what's so cool, that you have this history of like the New York Stock Exchange and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange that goes back, you know, well over 100 years. And they've actually learned a few things, right? And then when you have exchanges like MT Gox, right, they don't inherit any of that knowledge,
mm-hmm.
right? It's basically, you know, one idiot and a website. And which means that if, you know, you don't study the mistakes of the past, you're doomed to repeat them. And that's exactly what it is. You end up with this speed running of finance where I go into Mt. Gox and I'm looking at this and I'm like, wait a minute, they're not following like any of the rules that were came up with for certain reasons. Like, for example, you usually want to have a minimum pricing threshold, right? If somebody is selling, then their order is matched against whoever's the best bid. But the problem with that is you don't want the increment on the bid to be too small, because if somebody's the best bid, but then you outbid them by like a thousandth of a penny, then you're getting priority above them. And that doesn't make any sense, because there should be some minimum increment, maybe one penny or something, where you would actually have to meaningfully increase the amount you're willing to pay in order to get that order filled instead of them.
Right, right.
So they just basically ignored all this stuff, right? And the reason you don't want to do that is you don't want people just placing constantly meaningless orders, right? Because then they'll outbid you by a thousandth of a penny, then you outbid them by a thousandth of a penny, and it just is creating, you know, a lot of messages going back and forth without providing any particular value. Things like that, right? You know, people are putting in, you know, trading bots that are malfunctioning or, you know, are completely naive or, you know, don't have any sense of where anything should be. But honestly, the market itself can be like that, right? Because how many people buying and selling Bitcoin have a valuation model for Bitcoin and have an idea of what a reasonable price for Bitcoin should be? Because that's what tethers you to some kind of, you know, reality, right? Because people say, oh, the price is high, the price is low. But what does that even mean, right? Because all the Bitcoin, you know, moon boys years ago were like, we're going to $10,000, right? And then people and the critics were like, no, you're out of your mind. That's not zero chance, right? And then now the critics are saying, oh, Bitcoin's going to $10,000, you know, and the moon boy's like, 1 million. So is 10,000 high or is it low, right? And nobody has any reference to that. And because of that, people are get into the markets and they see their price up and they want to buy, and then they see the price down and they want to sell. And that's because they don't have some reference point. If they thought maybe, hey, the fair value of Bitcoin is maybe 30,000 now, but it can increase in the future, then maybe they wouldn't have been so bullish when we were at 60 and they wouldn't have been so bearish at 15.
Yeah. Fair value for Bitcoin, huh? Well, it's one Bitcoin.
But it's definitely tricky, right? And it also is because the speculation is ahead of the adoption. What I want to see is more Bitcoin circular economies, right? But they're small.
Yeah.
We need those to be a lot bigger. But the problem is it's so easy to grow speculation. It's so easy for some billionaire to go, yeah, I want $1 billion of that, right? Versus getting an entire community to say, yeah, we can use this as our currency for our transactions. That's more difficult. It's happening, but it's slower.
It's much slower. You reminded me of a tweet I saw, I don't know, a couple of days ago, maybe. No, it wasn't. It was a while ago. It was like Francis. I know, it was like something to do with Costa Rica. And the circular economy that's going down on there in the Bitcoin jungle. And there's just like an abundance of food in this picture. And it was all bought for Bitcoin. And
yeah, I saw that. And I was very tempted to go down to Uvita, you know, in both for the Nostra conference, and there's another thing happening that, you know, a bunch of people I know are there. And,
right.
But I know they'll get there eventually.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of...
It'll only be more developed at that point.
That's the fair value that you kind of look at well, I do anyway, like value is subjective, but I look at that and think, yeah, that's the kind of shit I want to buy with my Bitcoin, you know, because that's the move right there is the healthfulness of the food and the community and having that all spin around in that same place. It's that's the value, I think, the greatest value of Bitcoin. Like, I could give a shit about
it. Yeah, so I tell people, you know, don't buy Bitcoin because you want to become a millionaire. Buy Bitcoin because you recognize the fact that we're all going to be millionaires, but only some of us will be able to buy food.
Right.
Yes. You know, that's what it is. I carry around the Zimbabwe $100 trillion bill to show people this is $100 trillion.
You can get me a loaf of bread.
Yeah. That's the question. Can you buy a sandwich with it? No, I'm really asking you. Can I buy a sandwich with this? Mm-mm. That's what matters. Not writing zeros on a piece of paper. Does not feed anybody.
Yeah.
And Javier Milei put it. He said, you know, hey, if printing money solved poverty, then you know we could print diplomas to solve stupidity. So anyway, I actually ended up getting an ASIC a week later. You know, I got a box in the mail. And this was the Antminer S1. And nice. It didn't even have a case. It was just like bare circuit boards. It looked vaguely unsettling. It looked kind of like a bomb. And it didn't have a power supply either. You had to get a separate power supply. The recommendation was take a power supply from a computer. And then, you bend a paper clip and then, you know, insert that into certain ports so it would stay on. And, you know, you can connect it together, plug it in, and then it's like, okay, fan is whirring. That's the sound of money being made. You know, and I was like, okay, pretty cool. And then I'm looking at the results and I'm like, oh my God, there's zero possibility this will ever generate enough Bitcoin to cover the amount I paid for it.
Right. And the energy.
Not even counting electricity. Just that the difficulty was going up so fast that literally, you know, every day sooner you get it makes a substantial difference in its lifetime production, right? So in 2014, Bitcoin price went down 70% and the difficulty went up 30x. Right. So basically, if you plugged in a miner, you know, in the first couple of weeks, it was going to produce 50% of what it ever would at that point. That's how steep and scary it was. Whereas, you know, over the last few years, you know, people bought an S9 when it's new. And you know what? They just leave it going. Right. That kind of thing. So at one point, I had a couple ASICs, you know, in my small apartment, and I was paying an obscene amount for electricity. This was New York City. And, you know, I had them running in the kitchen while I'd sleep. And then as soon as I woke up, I'd unplug them, move them into the bedroom, plug them back in again, close the door. And I was pretty happy that I didn't have a girlfriend living with me at the time, because she would have definitely said to me, hey, it's either me or those. You can't just have like several hair dryers going 24/7, you know. I'm like, but that's the sound of money. It's nice. It keeps things really toasty warm in here all the time, right?
Oh, that's brilliant.
So yeah, so I realized, like, wait a minute, this is just not making sense. And then I can sell them, and I look on eBay. I'm like, wait a minute, they're selling on eBay for like twice what I paid for them. These people are, I'm getting ripped off, but these people are the greater fool. So I can sell them on eBay, then I can buy some more from the manufacturer, then sell them on eBay for more. And I'm like, hey, I am very smart. You know, I've discovered an easy arbitrage here, unlimited money hack. You know, I'm mining Bitcoin without ever mining them. I mean, I can have them plugged in, you know, like whatever in the day or two it takes them to sell on eBay, right? But that's it, right? And I don't think about it after that, just keep, you know, rinse, repeat. And then that seemed very, very clever up until then someone was a little bit more clever than me, where, you know, I sell an ASIC to somebody and then 4 weeks later, they say, yeah, it doesn't work. I want a full refund. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, you son of a gun. I can't believe it. You got me, because that, you know, eBay forced me to give them a full refund.
Clever.
While they got to mine for free for 4 weeks. I'm like, oh, that was... you know, I realized there's nothing I can do about it. I'm like, all right, well, that doesn't work, right? But, you know, I like to say, you know, people always think they missed the opportunity. It's like, no, there's always another one. It just might look different, right? But there's always another opportunity. You just have to, you know, keep your eyes open, keep your mind open, but not too open, and constantly be learning about new things and talking to people, especially people who are on the cutting edge, because there's a type of person who camps out in front of the Apple store for the iPhone 14 because it's one more than 13. And there's the kind of person that, you know, they won't use an ATM. They want to go to the bank and talk to a person because they don't trust those machines. Right. And those people exist at the same time. That there's the saying, the future's already here. It's just not evenly distributed. So you basically get to decide, you know, whether you're going to be on that cutting edge early adopter or not. Right. And there's benefits to being an early adopter. And there's also a lot of pain.
Yeah. You just racked my brain. I'm trying to think about this early adoption arbitrage because, yeah, there's something I was reading the other day, the pre-intellectual cutting edge of reality, which is where quality lies, which was where direct experience is. And if you can tap into that, there's a huge arbitrage to be had against everybody else. There's an interconnection there between the future is here, it's not evenly distributed. And you see that all the time. I mean, Bitcoiners are effectively walking around in the future. And you walk around and look at the vast majority of the population, and you just think, you don't have a clue. Like, even with Bitcoin pumping now, or in recent days, we still haven't hit that sort of retail FOMO fever yet. And it's really interesting because it's not ever sort of been like that. It's just, so you kind of walk around the future with this thing, and yeah, the retail FOMO to the people that I know and talk to and work with or whatever, they don't understand what the hell I'm talking about.
Yeah, there's someone I know that I was telling them to buy Bitcoin for quite some time, and they didn't buy it until it hit $50,000, and then they sold it 1 year later at $17,000.
Damn.
100%. They sold everything, and they managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, right? You have something that, come on, that, the time we've been talking about it, it's gone up 10x and you managed to lock in a 75% drop. So, it's like, all right, well, I kind of want to reach out to him about it again, but at the same time, like, curiosity compels me, like, at what price does he, mention it to me? At 100K? 200? Yeah. I don't know.
At what point does the woodwork become active again? That's, this is an interesting question,
right? There's the fun of the bull market, but also the sheer terror that things are going to break, that, real people are going to horrifically misallocate their funds, right? Because for some reason, I put it out there like, hey, happy to help people with any of their Bitcoin stuff or tangentially related Bitcoin stuff. And then it hurts me when people reach out to me and they're like, oh yes, I need to go buy, whatever, blah, 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 altcoin that I've never heard of on some other exchange I've never heard of. And I'm like, what? Why did you do this? And they're like, well, I paid a lot of money for this newsletter from some random lunatic. And he's told me to buy these coins. I'm like, wait, this guy just ripped you off twice. He charged you a lot of money for his newsletter when he's just some random person. And two, then he's trying to unload, illiquid bags on you. I mean, this just terrible. I'm like, do you really want me to help you do this? Like, I'm not that comfortable with that.
It never ceases to amaze me. You can give the most sound advice, but some people just want to touch that stove, and you've got to let them. People are people. And I've sort of,
right. And I tell people, Bitcoin could go up or could go down. Right. And someone else tells them, oh yeah, my magic altcoin is guaranteed to do 1,000x. They're like, I like that guarantee.
Yeah, fill your boots. Let's see how it plays out. It's an interesting strategy, Cotton. Let's see how it plays out.
Exactly. So, yeah. So then the nice thing for me was when at the point where I started meeting other actual Bitcoiners in person, and then I wasn't just the lone crazy person trying to talk to friends and family while they just stared at me like I had three heads and waited for me to stop talking and then politely change the subject. That's all. That was that experience of just being completely alone and then finally meeting some other people. And I realized, like, okay, I don't have to try to convince these people. You know, they already came to it through their own way, whatever way that might be, right? There's different paths. Maybe they just like conspiracy theories and, you know, they read something about the Federal Reserve and then that led them to it. That's fine. Right. Or something else entirely. And, you know, they're into space and technology in the future. And then they've decided that, you know, that's what makes sense. You know, I've been following, you know, robotics closely for a long time and waiting for robotics to have its moment. It hasn't quite had it yet. You know, I got a robotic vacuum cleaner and then just, you know, watch it, you know, knock over things and crash into walls. I'm like, all right, tech's not there. You know, soon we'll have this awesome automated future, but we're not quite there. But I feel like, you know, Bitcoin's having its moment. AI is having its moment and robotics will come next. And then you think about, okay, there's different robots and there's, you know, AI intelligences and, you know, they want to, you know, pay for some data, pay for some energy, you know, farm out some tasks to specialized ones. Well, how are they going to do that? Are they going to open bank accounts or are they going to write paper checks? Are they going to, you know, pass each other coins or pieces of paper? You know, none of that really quite makes sense. They're going to swipe some plastic. I mean, basically they want to use something that's, you know, where the information is the value, mm-hmm. something that's digitally native. And in fact, they can handle Bitcoin better than I can, better than humans can, because humans still need technology, you know, as the intermediary there. There's no way around that. We can't do the cryptographic calculations in our head.
That's a wild thought.
Can't broadcast it, right? Yeah, so the robots can be using it seamlessly. It's beautiful. They can just telepathically pay each other. Done.
So given what you've been talking about thus far, you've had clearly a knowledge of money and the problem of value exchange across the internet long before sort of Bitcoin came on the scene. You were fairly finely tuned to receiving that information and not dismissing it out of hand straight away. There's like a curiosity there where you're like, all right, that sounds interesting, particularly when you were talking about the search for aliens and using that spare CPU to sort of just contribute to that search. The analogy, you know, is fairly intuitive then once you understand that to, oh, cool, I'll just like leave my computer on and maybe I can extract a little bit of value and see how that goes. And just from a pure curiosity play. So has discovering Bitcoin changed you?
Yeah, I would say so.
And how?
Well, for me, I feel like that's been something that I could latch on to, that I was earlier than other people, and it matters. Right. So, you know, I had a Facebook account before the vast majority of other people did, you know, years before. And that didn't really help me in any way. You know, I had, you know, high speed internet access, home internet access before a lot of people. Maybe that helped me with getting some information, I guess, and learning. But yeah, with Bitcoin, it actually puts me in that position where I feel like, OK, yeah, I actually have some, I can do something. I can explain Bitcoin to people. I can try to help this thing grow. I'm obviously a small part of it, but that could actually change the world for the better, right? So when you had things like, you know, whatever, Google stock does well, Amazon stock does well, you know, it accidentally makes a couple people rich, but that doesn't really matter, right? The fact that some people bought the stock and it went up, okay, great, good for them.
Mm-hmm.
But what matters is the value that's created, right? So some of it gets captured, but the value that's created can be so absolutely massive. So it feels exciting to be a small part of that. It's really neat to meet other people who, even though they're Bitcoiners, they can be wildly different people. There are certain things that they seem to understand intuitively as well. There might be some things in common despite those differences, so on. And And Bitcoin did actually force me to go back and look at some other things differently and think, okay, you know, can we build other structures that where nobody is in charge, but everyone has an incentive to stay within the consensus, right? It, can we build on top of Bitcoin to create like reputation identity systems and other things that could solve some problems here? So yeah, it's definitely helped me with, you know, optimism that we're building something positive here, even if other things look kind of concerning. And that's all. And also just to expose that, you know, you see like skyscrapers and you see people in suits and, you know, you think, wow, those people must really, you know what they're doing. And then in some ways, Bitcoin exposes some of that, right? That there's even, you know, investing gurus that I've looked up to, and they've said a lot of smart things and they've obviously done very well for themselves, but they're still not able to wrap their heads around something new like Bitcoin that doesn't fit into an existing category. It's kind of incredible to see them struggle with that, whereas it's more natural for me. So I've done classes where I'm like explaining Bitcoin to people, you know, Bitcoin 101. And I said part of the problem with it is that it's at the intersection of multiple topics that the average person has basically zero understanding of. Mm. How much does the average person know about information security, about encryption, about hashing algorithms, right? About peer-to-peer networking, about, you know, game theory and incentives. It's at the intersection of all those topics that, again, I'm in the, you know, very unusual situation of actually digging into all sorts of things, actually having, my own reading, but as well as the formal education, economics and business and trading and so on. And even then it's a struggle for me, right? And even then it's a challenging combination of a lot of different things. So it's hard for the average person. I just at least try to think in terms of, okay, what do they know? Mm-hmm. And then can I use analogies in terms of that, right? How is this interesting to them? How does this make sense to them? How is it relevant to them personally? Because it's different things to different people, and that's totally fine.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Like, the idea that you're trying to communicate this, when Bitcoin lands on your lap, it's really difficult to understand, and it's still difficult to understand. Like, you have to be an insanely curious person to even be bothered with something like this. But there is only just like, it's a framing thing, right? Like, it's just how, what's that first touch point where it's framed in the right way for you to actually go start that process of going down the rabbit hole and making sure that it's framed in a way that's going to resonate most with that person that you're trying to communicate the value and the importance yep. of this thing, this technology. And most people have so many other things on their minds, and a lot of people actually can't be bothered, really. You know, hence why the ETFs absolutely exist.
Absolutely. That's that for a lot of people. They're like, hey, I'm much too busy, you know, with, watching my sporting team, you know, win or lose, or, trying to figure out how I can pay the rent this month, or mm-hmm. whatever else it might be. And they just don't have those extra hours or that extra channel in their brain to really work on something new and different, behaves in different ways. Right. You know, when I help someone set up a hardware wallet, I told them, okay, write down the seed words on a piece of paper. Don't put it on any computer anywhere. And then they take a picture of it right after writing it down and upload it to iCloud. And I said, no, you're not supposed to do that. You know, it's not supposed to be on a computer anywhere, right? So they're like, okay, I just deleted it from iCloud. And I said, that's not good enough, right? You have to do the whole thing again the right way. And that idea that, you know, that if you, in order for something to be a secret, you don't tell anyone ever. That's not something most people are used to. No. They're used to the idea of passwords, and the password is just the name of their dog that they talk about constantly on Facebook. And they have no idea. They think, oh, well, I forgot the password, but I'll just reset it. And there we go. No problem. And then I have a password and I type it into this website. I type into that website, type into that. Well, no, it's a secret. You don't run and go around telling everybody, right? The only thing you have that you know no one else knows is a large random number you generated yourself. You know no one else knows that because you made it and you didn't tell anybody. And once you tell one person, then it's out there. It's not a secret anymore, period. So the only thing you should be doing to prove you have that number is not to show people the number. It's to basically sign a message using a little bit of math that, you know, people don't understand. And now you show people the signature of that message, not the, you know, the key used to make it itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that signature, it's okay to put out there. People know that you know it and they don't know it. And that's good. That's the right way. And that technology dates back to the 1970s with Diffie and Hellman's, you know, paper on that. And we should have just adopted that from the beginning. And if we did, instead of passwords, instead of this whole, you know, just mess that's been created, social media accounts that don't belong to you, they belong to, you know, some for-profit company. If we'd done that from the beginning, Bitcoin would be a lot easier to understand because it'd be the same idea. It's like, hey, you have a key that you keep, you know, secret. You know, you have hardware wallets that you use to protect your identity on social media accounts. Well, now you can also use the same ones or, you know, another one, right, to protect your money. Just like you, you know, keep cash in a locked box or something. That would be very intuitive and natural. And people would understand this idea of, yeah, don't tell anybody. If someone calls you up and tells you some whole weird story and now you have to give them the seed words, no, you wouldn't do that. No matter what, for any reason, right? Maybe you'd send them some money for some reason, but you wouldn't actually give the seed words because that's never part of the actual flow.
Exactly. Yeah. What have you learned about the world and, more importantly, yourself since discovering Bitcoin?
Well, yeah, I mean, there were a whole lot of things that I thought were, you know, theoretical until, you know, you experience it, right? You know, a lot of people have this idea. They think, oh, well, I'm walking, you know, in a dark alleyway by myself at night. And, you know, if somebody tries to mug me, you know, they imagine themselves in this scenario and they think, well, maybe I'll fight them or maybe I'll, you know, refuse to give the money or maybe I'll run away or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. And they have this idea in their head of what they would do, but they don't know. You find out when you're in that situation. You actually find out something about yourself. Right. So with Bitcoin, right, I got to experience, you know, the roller coaster and different things like that. And you do learn something. I got to learn what happens when, you know, I, you know, get the, you know, some money that I didn't expect. And I learned what happens to myself, you know, when I lose some money through my own mistakes or through somebody else's mistakes or through trusting another person or, you know, having to make those difficult decisions of, hey, Bitcoin's up, you know, do I sell it to pay some debt or do I, you know, take out loans to try to buy some more?
Right.
Right. And each one of those decisions has just such an immediate, profound effect on your life because everything you're doing always affects it, right? Whether you're deciding, hey, should I go to college? Should I move to a different country? Right. Should I start a conversation with that person sitting over there? Each one of those things changes your life. But often, you know, you don't see those immediate results. You don't see those alternate pathways. And with Bitcoin, you're forced to make those choices and you see what those alternate pathways would have been, right? So you see, you can, you know, pretty straightforward and easily do the math and say, oh, yeah, if I had sold Bitcoin there, I would do this. If I had bought Bitcoin there, I would have done that. And you have to come to peace with that. You have to find a way to accept that you're constantly, every single second of your life, making decisions that have very profound impacts, good and bad.
Uh-huh. Without you even knowing it, maybe in real time, in that moment. It's interesting.
Right. And also, again, right, people say, oh, I'm just hodling Bitcoin. That's a decision, right?
Yes.
Because you're choosing every day not to sell the Bitcoin that you have. And you know what? Bitcoin's had time locks in it for a long time. So I told people, I'm like, okay, you're telling me you're holding for 5 years. Are you willing to lock your Bitcoin for 5 years? Because if you lock them, you cannot move them for 5 years. right? So the bad thing is, right, if you have some kind of emergency, you know, your relative needs expensive surgery or something to save their life, and then you can't tap into it. But it also means that it's a forced hodl. It can't be stolen from you in that time. You can't, give into weakness and liquidate it yourself. So you can do that. But the reality is that almost nobody is doing that, right? And then, of course, the question is, if somebody offered to pay you to do that, say, hey, I'm nervous Michael Saylor is going to dump his Bitcoin in the next 4 years. Hey, Michael Saylor, we'll pay you, we'll pay you this much money to time lock it for the amount of time you said you're not going to sell. Is he going to do that? Right. Maybe not. So there is that time value of money. If somebody said, hey, here's the seed words to some, Bitcoin, but it's time locked for 100 years. Well, that's not interesting to me,
Yeah.
That's cool, and I appreciate that people have lowered their time preference to the point where they're worried about their great-great-grandchildren. But honestly, I think the world's going to change so radically in the future in ways that people don't expect that, any kind of linear extrapolation is a big mistake.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, we'll go back to what we were talking about before with the iPhone, and who could have guessed that from an iPod, this heavy, cumbersome thing with limited disk space turns into like a revolutionary device or an evolutionary device that people just walk around with staring at all the time. No one can predict that.
Absolutely. And then you see like, okay, well, where does that go to? Does that go to goggles on your head? Does it go to a chip in your brain? Or does it go to, an even more extreme change in humanity? And of course, at that point, maybe I'll be the Luddite and I'm saying, no chips for me, thanks. No, I don't want to upload my consciousness into the network and, dispose of the frail human form. But the reality is that if that's enough of a benefit to people, it's hard not to adopt that at a certain point, right? If the people with chips in their head are making 100 times as much money and are just completely, completely unstoppable at everything, there's only so long you can avoid doing that.
Yeah. It's interesting that there's early adopters for people that want to put chips in their heads or their arm or whatever, which has happened. And they're quite happy to early adopt something as radical as that. Actually, it's not even radical. Radical is not the right word. Insane. Because radical, actually, I was listening to Turtomista the other day. He was saying that the root of radical is radus, which is Latin for root. So you sort of connect that to radish or whatever. But so it's not like radical at all. It's just completely insane, but people are able to, I guess, rationalize putting a chip in their head or their arm so they can like buy groceries more conveniently and just at a checkout, but they will not early adopt a form of payment, a form of currency that is native to the internet that helps you like make payments across time and space all across the world in real time in instant settlement and all that sort of stuff. It's human beings are nuts, yeah. Man.
Yeah. So that's the thing, for someone to become a Bitcoiner, they have to be open-minded enough to leave the traditional finance space of stocks and bonds, but they can't be so open-minded that they go all the way over into, meme coins and nonsense and so on. Right. And you see people like that where they may as well be, betting on a horse at a racetrack, and they're like, well, this horse has a cool name, and, this horse is called Lucky Horse, so, I'm going to put all my money on that. There's no, there isn't really any understanding of what's going on here. They all just look like a bunch of different tickers, a bunch of different penny stocks they can put their money into and hope for the best, right? But there's always the case where, the Hail Mary play, that high risk thing like a lottery ticket, can actually make logical sense. If somebody's in an environment where it's basically impossible for them to save up money, then any money that they have, they are better off putting it into something that at least gives them a small chance of escaping the trap that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
just like if somebody lives in a country that's, you know, in the midst of a civil war and there's all sorts of horrible diseases going around and the life expectancy is 35, it doesn't really make sense for them to save for their retirement at 65.
No.
Right? If they have some money now, if they have some food now, if they have some resources now, they should use it.
Precisely. Precisely.
So, and then think about a way to try to get out of that situation if they can, to one where they could, if they want to save for retirement, then one is, you know, escape.
Right. Ideally. Given your time in the space, how do you explain Bitcoin?
I always have to, you know, start with who I'm talking to, right? Uh-huh. Is it somebody who has relatives in another country, someone who experienced hyperinflation or like Corralito, where, you know, the government literally just stole money out of people's bank accounts and retirement accounts? You know, is it somebody who's interested in open source software, or, you know, are they annoyed with, you know, corporations, or are they worried about, you know, methane gas being vented into the atmosphere?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it really just comes down to, you know, where they are and who they are. And I'll start with that. Yep. Not just give a, you know, generic spiel, because again, right, the approaches that some people take are, you know, much too corporate or whatever, and the approaches other people take that are way too radical for my taste, right? Maybe they're like, well, you know, we won't have governments or banks anymore, and I think that's kind of ridiculous, right? There's people who think that Bitcoin somehow replaces credit markets or derivatives, right? There won't be any borrowing or lending, or I think there won't even be stocks or something. It's kind of bizarre to me, and I think maybe they don't understand what stocks are. They don't understand what Bitcoin is. Maybe both. You know, Bitcoin's not something that's just going to go up in purchasing power forever, right? It can go up in fiat number forever,
mm-hmm.
sure, right? But obviously, there's a point where, you know, Bitcoin slows down and or, you know, stops in terms of purchasing power, because, you know, maybe, whatever, like, you know, if you can buy a nice house for, say, 10 Bitcoin now, well, maybe that'll be one Bitcoin for a nice house in the future. But you can't tell me that, you know, one Bitcoin is going to buy 10,000 houses in the future. I don't think that's, you know, remotely reasonable.
Who would want 10,000 houses? I mean, some people, I guess.
Well, I mean, you know, the equivalent market of that, right? Or you know, 10,000 acres of land, or however you want to put it, right?
But yeah.
There's definitely a point. I don't know. I don't know
the marginal utility of value?
Yeah, there's a point where, you know, Bitcoin reaches some level of purchasing power, and it's not going to appreciate much beyond that. Or if it does, it's not going to be appreciating at, you know, 100, 200% a year. I'll put it that way, right?
Right.
And so I would, you know, divide Bitcoin into the two phases, right? There's a growth phase, and then there's a maturity phase. And that's totally fine. And I get it that there's people who think, no, it's just growth forever. And then obviously that's going to work for them for now. And then they're just going to be a little frustrated in the maturity phase. But that doesn't matter, right? If they're still hodling, they'll do just fine. They'll just, you know, be confused. And that's okay. So that's better than being wiped out. Right. And one of the things that's interesting to me is the idea of DLCs, discrete log contracts. It's basically a way that you know, two people with Bitcoin can basically make a kind of bet between each other. They can create a derivative between each other that's peer-to-peer, and that's actually enforced by the logic of the Bitcoin network itself, right? And that can be on-chain or it can be on Lightning. And this actually lets you transfer that Bitcoin dollar fluctuation from one person to the other.
Mm-hmm.
So if one person is the degenerate hyper bull, right, they can choose to take on more exposure to the price of Bitcoin, and the other person can choose to give away their exposure to the price of Bitcoin such that their number of sats goes up and down, but the dollar value of it stays still. Right? While the other person there, their number of sats is going to go up and down, and the dollar value of it is swinging wildly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because for every person who wants to get rid of their exposure to the price of Bitcoin, there's somebody who wants to take on more of it if they can. So when you pair up these people, when you create this market to transfer that risk, now it makes it a lot easier for the circular economies to get going. Because think about if you're running a restaurant or something, and you're everyone's paying in Bitcoin, but your rent is denominated in dollars.
Yep.
How do you know that you're going to be able to pay the rent at the end of the month, even if, you know, you're a nice, profitable, popular business? You don't know that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the result is you're kind of having to set aside that Bitcoin. You know, you have to sell some of that Bitcoin, right? Or you have to, you know, receive some revenue in dollars or something. That's not ideal. But if you can actually receive the Bitcoin and then use this on-chain derivative to stabilize the value of your Bitcoin or some partially with respect to the dollar, now you know you can cover the rent and you can continue operating the business and you still have the Bitcoin and you never had to deal with a bank or, you know, unwanted third party, right? Or someone who could just arbitrarily take away your money.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty huge. I think that's the key to getting some of these circular economies growing a lot faster. It's the key to getting people who are interested in the technology but don't want the exposure to the price. They don't want the excitement. They don't want the roller coaster. And, of course, all the people who do want to, you know, have more exposure to Bitcoin, whether they're individuals or hedge funds or that kind of thing, they can now get it from these people. And it's just a big win-win, and I feel like there's a lot of Bitcoiners that have been kind of sleeping on this. It's starting to get some attention now.
Yeah, wow. I'd have to give that a little bit more thought to fully unpack all of that, but
absolutely. And it's more intuitive to me because I worked on trading floors, I worked in electronics trading, I worked mm-hmm. with a lot of different derivatives contracts, so it just kind of makes sense. And I get it, it's you know, pretty new for a lot of people. When I've explained it to some Bitcoiners, they're like, isn't that gambling? I'm like, no, it's like the opposite of gambling.
Right.
It's like, it's only gambling in the same way having insurance on your car is gambling, right? You're moving risk to somebody who's better able to handle it. The original paper was written by Taz Dryja, who also, you know, wrote Lightning. And E3XO. And but it's been, you know, it's been a number of years in the incubation. You know, this was a lot of work to do to get this actually functional, and we're starting to finally see the fruits now.
What does Bitcoin mean to you?
I mean, it's a lot of different things, right? It's a political movement. It's an expression of the open source values, in the same vein as Linux and so on, right? It's something that, you know, even if it succeeds, it doesn't necessarily succeed in the way you expect,
right?
People in the 90s who were Linux fans were saying Linux is going to take over the desktop. And it turns out they never took over the desktop, and yet it still wins anyway because the desktop became irrelevant and it took over everything else.
Mm-hmm.
variations of it ended up taking over the majority of phones, the majority of servers, all these other things. That, you know, only if you actually see the code, do you know what your computer is doing, that you know that it's actually working for you and not for somebody else. Bitcoin is, it's hope, right? It's something that where you can clearly see things are getting better despite other things being challenging, right? There's still war and there's still awful things happening in the world. And Bitcoin is something that helps to, at least put more people on a fair footing, right? Whether you're in a country that's in some way marginalized from the rest of the world, or whether you're too young to be taken seriously, or whether you're somebody who's been discriminated against because of your race or gender or something. It's nice to have something that, you know, puts every human on the same level playing field, right?
Mm-hmm.
Previously, it was only, you know, some super rich people who had access to the Swiss bank accounts, and Bitcoin breaks down that door, letting everybody save in a way that can't be confiscated easily. And again, imagine that situation, right? If you were born in a country where people routinely come by and just shake you down and take your money, right? Whether that's local gangs or the government or something else, right? Maybe that's your own family, that you're female, and your family says, oh no, you're female, you're not allowed to have money, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you build wealth? How do you get out of that trap, right? And Bitcoin is something that opens up that pathway. So I think it's, you know, there's a whole bunch of different things. And again, I think with DLCs, with some other things, Bitcoin could end up being a way to get people who are outside the financial system access to capital markets, access to investing in, say, U.S. stocks or something else that they wouldn't be able to via indirect channels. And it could be really, really nice opportunity for a lot of people. So that's all. I see it as a couple different things and generally a net positive.
Yeah, that's all. No, I mean, it's so much more, but it's a great start.
But yeah, obviously I can, you know, talk for 60 hours straight.
Oh, I mean, it's just that your wealth of knowledge with respect to your experiences in and around Bitcoin, and particularly from the perspective of trading and computer science and just the sheer time up that you have in the space is super insightful. Daniel, thank you for sharing some scarce time, finite energy, telling us the tale of how you discovered Bitcoin. Where can people find you? Where can people find out more about your work? Where can people find how to contact and connect and, find out a little bit more?
So still the best place to see what I'm saying about Bitcoin is on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
It's at DKA218. And, you know, from there, I mean, my DMs are open and, you know, you can see links to other stuff I've done. So, you know, I'm working on writing more about Bitcoin and trying to get more, you know, videos and more helpful stuff out there to do whatever I can in the growth phase of Bitcoin while it's still the growth phase, while it's still exciting before it gets boring. So it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on that. You know, time flew by, but happy to share my experiences and hopefully, you know, other people, you know, get to skip over some of the mistakes I made and get right to the good stuff. Just...